This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Gauteng and FMR in Cape Town.
Well, let's put the finance minister's Twitter account to one side for a moment, shall we? A century ago this year, artillery fell silent across Europe. Communists dismantled an empire, and the most devastating pandemic in six centuries swept the globe. The events of 1918 still resonate with us today. On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year, the gunfire of World War I ceased over borders wholly transformed by the conflict. The bodies of the fallen littered Europe from the English Channel to the Adriatic Sea. Politically and socially, we saw the ripple effects reaching far beyond the trenches and the chemical labs from which the war had been fought. We had Russia reeling from the previous year's revolution, enduring a vicious civil war punctuated by the execution of Tsar Nicholas II. And in Finland, we had its own civil war after breaking from the Russian Empire. Polish troops, fresh off their nation's declaration of statehood, massacred Jews in 3 days of pogroms. And all the while, the Spanish flu was ripping around the world, killing many victims within hours of their first symptoms. The deadliest pandemic since the Black Death, six centuries earlier, claimed more lives in all the battles of World War I, lest we forget. But like small shoots pushing through cracks in concrete, some signs of a better future could be glimpsed. In Britain, for example, most women over 30 gained the right to vote. And in the US, the 19th Amendment cleared the House of Representatives, moving women closer to full suffrage. But ahead of the armistice centennial, there are ominous signs that we're about to repeat the mistakes of the past, almost zombie-like. And Brooke Spector, former US diplomat in Africa and East Asia and associate editor at the Daily Maverick, is on the line to talk about where we find ourselves 100 years on. Evening, Brooks.
Good evening. Good to be with you again.
And welcome to Raymond Parsons, professor at the Northwest University School of Business and Governance. Raymond, good to see you again.
Good evening, Michael.
And Warwick Lucas is still with us. Warwick, thanks for staying for the conversation. Now, Raymond, kick us off here. We're seeing this slow deconstruction of the post-World War I and World War II world order, which had at its root this Bretton Woods idea to achieve a never-again world. And the things that I'm watching at the moment in particular are trade wars, because trade wars tend to have a nasty habit of causing world wars, history shows. Will this time be any different?
Well, let me start by saying, Michael, that you've spoken about the century since the end of the First World War. And perhaps that historical departure point just needs to be emphasized as we move into this discussion, because we've spoken about the armistice that was signed on the 11th of November, which was the conclusion of the First World War. The Second World War was concluded with an unconditional surrender. Now, the problem with the armistice was that although an armistice was signed, when it got to the Treaty of Versailles, it was treated as an unconditional surrender, and the treaty was imposed on the Germans. That is a very clear departure point, which unleashed a number of subsequent economic and political factors, which we will discuss. Certainly, it led to the great inflation in Germany. It led to the imposition of the Treaty of Versailles, although it was later modified, but it was embedded as a negative point. Then came the Great Depression, and so Germany was ready for radical nationalism, and we know what happened there. But the fact remains that it did unleash a whole lot of factors, both political and economic, of which we are still grappling with some of the consequences. And in the 1930s, we are singling out, of course, as we will, of course, the United States backing off from a multilateral system. They did that in the 1930s. They wouldn't join the League of Nations. There was the Smart-Hootley tariffs, all of which, as economic factors, were one of the economic factors which created the tensions leading up to the Second World War. So you could argue, in a way, that the ending of the First World War simply sowed the seeds for the Second World War, both economically and politically. The question now is, since the Second World War, we've rediscovered multilateralism. We have sought to create multilateral institutions. But after so many decades, we've got to understand what has developed are two faces of globalization. The one is growth, and the world has seen many people lifted out of poverty. No doubt on that level, a very successful story. But as we know, there are winners and losers. And what has happened with globalization in the recent years is that the losers have become very acute. They have accessed politics, and whether it's a Trump or Brexit or Marie Le Pen or the decline of Angela Merkel, it all adds up to the fact that the losers are making themselves heard. And so we're really at a crossroad now. We really have to say, can we retrieve the situation? Can we create a better balance in globalization, in multilateral trade, and in multilateral institutions which can retrieve the situation? Because there's no doubt in the long run that being more engaged in trade and investment is a, quote, good thing for most people, but not for everyone. And we need to address that. And I think we actually, in some ways, need to save globalization from its sternest supporters. We actually have to find a way to adjust it in a way that we ensure its long-term survival and that we don't retreat into beggar my neighbor policies. That will certainly be an extremely negative factor for those who participate, especially the small open economies in the global economy.
Yeah, such as South Africa's. Now, Brooks, on that point, and I would like to pick up on one specific issue that Raymond mentioned, the fact of winners and losers in the new globalized world post the Bretton Woods deal. Are there really winners and losers in a world where the base effects required the global south and the developing world to exceed, in terms of growth rate, the developed world in order to catch up? Or is it just that they won at a faster rate than the global north?
Well, let me just add a couple of points to the quick summary that Raymond gave. He's used to giving these kinds of summaries because he teaches for a living too, so he understands how to do that. But there's one thing that was left out of his picture, and that's technological change, the disruptive impacts. And there's been a lot of study of the losers in the American economy, those people whose jobs have migrated to China and then on to Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and wherever else they've gone. And the jobs have disappeared largely in the U.S., not completely, but largely as a result of technology rather than the movement of whole factories. Even if Donald Trump were right and he succeeded in returning coal industries to the heartland of the United States and the Midwest, they wouldn't hire all the people that used to be in those jobs 30, 40 years ago, because the technology of producing whatever it is, if it is still needed, has changed dramatically in the interim. It takes far fewer people to make the same product than it would have. So from that point then, the disruptiveness in the current global economy is not simply a function of protectionism and other kinds of issues, but it's also this enormously disruptive impact of ever-increasing technological application to industry. But let me make a second point about the United States specifically. I mean, it's become a kind of a given that the country has moved into a protectionist mindset, away from alliances, away from international engagement, and so forth. And although it is true that those have been the kinds of policies Donald Trump has vocalized, the surveys that I've looked at in the last couple of days on global involvement by the United States show, interestingly, that the vast majority of people in the country still support an engagement with allies, and engagement with international institutions, and engagement with the global economy. It's not that the people as a whole have been driven from those views. It's that some politicians have managed to use the fears and angsts about what might happen as a lever for gaining power in a divided political circumstance. And I suspect much of the same is true with the Brexiteers. I suspect you can see it. You can see something similar to it in France and maybe even Germany. And you certainly see it in parts of Eastern Europe. And I guess the final point I would make is that even Donald Trump, in his most vocal excesses, has not yet said we need to leave the WTO, the World Trade Organization. We need to leave NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We need not to have trade relations with China and so forth. His whole pitch has been whatever we do must be fairer. And I think at least in terms of China, you can say that the Chinese have managed to find real chinks in the armor of things and exploit intellectual property weaknesses, have managed to rig deals so that if you want to invest in China, you have to declare access to technology, you have to change ownership structures of operating subsidiaries and so forth. It's all legal, but it does put businesses at a disadvantage if they're foreign businesses.
Yeah, I mean, they are. And to pick up on that last point, in particular, Brooks, merits to Trump attacking the Chinese are not playing on a level playing field when it comes to the expropriation of IP and the way they have competed in the World Trade Organization era with their own set of labor rules. But Warwick, to bring this back to the economic reality that faces America as the world's hegemonic power, which it still is if you look at the size of the US economy, they still rely as a heavily structurally indebted nation. If you look at that fiscal deficit over in the US on the likes of China and the Japanese and others to continue buying their debt and their T-bills. So for them to fully withdraw into an isolationist stance wouldn't long-term suit them either.
Not really. I mean, if you look at the U.S. economy, you've got to remember the dividend line of that economy. But certainly tech is very, very important. I mean, just to give a context, and we've spoken about it before, but I'll put it out there again. Looking at where the tech contribution to the global economy stands, it's basically around about 8% of global GDP, give or take. Now, our new frontline technologies are artificial intelligence, cryptocurrencies, and other sorts of crypto, Internet of Things, 3D printing, 5G, quantum computing to come out within the next 10 years. I mean, the basic development has actually already been done there. So in the next 10 years, tech's contribution to global GDP will double. That's possibly one of the safest predictions I can make. The stakes are enormous. And to basically have a situation where the world's second biggest economy is not properly on board with IP protection is unacceptable. So I'm not surprised that Trump is digging in.
Raymond?
If I could just come, I think understandably, when we talk about globalization and its discontents, I'm including technology, and this has been well emphasized by my colleagues. I think the important point here is that if we stand back and say, well, how do we turn this around? I think what has happened, in my view, is that economic globalization has outpaced political globalization. In other words, we've surged ahead with technology, trade, and investment. Too many people have been left behind. But the institutions that ought to be reformed in order to have a better agenda to address this imbalance, I think of the IMF, I think of the WTO, I think a few others, they've lagged behind. And now a message is coming that unless they are able to enforce fairer and better rules, whether it's on the technology front, trade front, or some of the conditions that the IMF does impose when it comes to help you, or at least to help a country. It reminds me of what Reagan once said, that the most damaging 9 words that he could think of as a Reagan, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. So I think when it comes to the IMF, that's probably also true, although I have a great respect for them. I quite clearly they have a role to play. But I think I come back to my point that the economic globalization has paced vastly ahead of the political global, in other words, the institutions that need to govern the rules, enforce the rules, make for better rules so that you do not get a backlash and that you get a better balance in the so-called two faces of globalization, because we will need that process in the longer term. We don't want to throw, you know, we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and, you know, with the bathwater. And just to come back, because I'm not sure we'll have time, whatever may or may not be going wrong in the world economy, the more a country has its house in order, the better it can deal with any global headwinds. And so I think we've just got to remember that when we talk about the South African situation.
Exactly. So what does all of this boil down and mean for South Africa as a fairly small open economy in the global scheme of things? When we see, Brooks, the elephants of the US and China going at it the way they are, it is the grass that tends to get trampled underneath. As a concluding thought, though, with the gridlock government over in the US, what now for Trump's trade war with China?
Let me just play off on your last comment there about elephants and grass being trampled. That was one of Lee Kuan Yew's favorite phrases, but then he always added a codicil. He said, you know, when the elephants make love, the grass doesn't come out any better. And there is a warning implicit in that, of course, which is that when there are difficulties between major nations, you can find the interstices and the niches of opportunity. But when the large nations have found cooperative means and agree on most big things, the small players can get trampled. And you have to be really adroit and really quick and to find their opportunities. Let me just draw against the most recent U.S. election results, because this is something I've had to live with for the last 3 days. But the one thing that I don't think I've seen mentioned much, which is very clearly true, that for the House of Representatives vote, it was very clearly a repudiation in many ways of the Trumpian economic doctrine, both domestically and internationally. It was not support for more protectionism. It was not a support for withdrawal and retreat from institutions, whether they are the WTO in its current arthritic form or in a tougher one. They were, in fact, electing the people of the U.S., electing representatives, especially from districts that are better educated, slightly better off than the national average, and women, who presumably are more forward-thinking than men. These were people who decided that we need to counterbalance some of that baloney with a group of people who have seen the world, many of them, and who understand that the future of the country is that way rather than in a tight, inward-looking, protective shell.
We've got to stop it on that point, Raymond. We have run out of time, unfortunately. A rules-based international system, and we have seen 100 years on from the armistice that at least the fact that we see so many more women and such a diverse array of candidates coming into the system show that we have moved on, but there are still some very alarming similarities. That was Brooke Spector, former U.S. diplomat and associate editor at the Daily Maverick, joining Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University School of Business and Governance and Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer of Galileo Asset Managers.